Hi, and welcome to Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host today, Dr. Amber Luong from the McGovern Medical School of the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston. Today, I've invited Dr. Serena Mueller from Frederick Alexander University Erlangen, Nuremberg in Germany to discuss her manuscript entitled Comparison of Mucus and Serum Biomarker Sampling in Chronic Rhinosinusitis with Nasal Polyps from this month's edition of IFAR. So welcome, Dr. Mueller. Thanks for taking the time today. So before we jump into your study, tell us a little bit about your career background. I see that you spent some time at Mass Eye and Ear.
Yeah, first of all, thank you for having me and for the nice introduction. So yeah, I am a physician in Germany, Frederick Alexander University, Erlangen-Nuremberg, and I was lucky enough to spend my postdoc at Mass Eye and Ear with Ben Bleier. So this is also where all the ideas about this study actually started and where the whole biomarker research started. So this is a little bit about my background, but also at the same time, the background for this study.
Well, excellent. And so you spent did you spend a year or 2 years in Boston? And did you enjoy the cold weather, or is it very similar to Germany?
Oh, I so much enjoyed the year there. I had been there for some sub-internships before, so I knew the team, and I loved it. So I came back for that postdoc, and it was a great, great time. And I think this is also the moment to thank Dr. Bleier for the support and his brilliant ideas and the great discussions we have and continue to have, although my fellowship was 7 years ago. So I think this is one thing I want to do here. And about the weather, it was actually much colder than I knew it from Germany, although people think Germany is a very cold country. So we had I talk Celsius, so we had kind of minus 15 Celsius at some point, and that's really rare here. But I could adjust pretty well, so it was good. I had a great time.
Nice. Great. That's awesome. So, I mean, it's great that you still have such a strong collaboration with some people, you know, with Dr. Bleier, even 7 years later. So that's amazing. So I'm going to just jump right on in. So in your study in general, mucus versus serum as a medium for identifying biomarkers, what was kind of the impetus of the study? You mentioned that it sort of all came out from your time at Boston. Where did it all come from?
So, yeah, when I was in Boston, we did a study where we pretty much looked at tissue versus non-invasive mucus biomarkers. And then we compared exosomal markers and whole mucus markers. So this was kind of the first study when I was actually getting in touch with a whole biomarker topic. So we were coming from mucus, basically, and we were doing the following years a couple of non-invasive mucus biomarker studies to identify new biomarkers, to validate them, and actually also to see if mucus biomarkers could predict recurrences. And then we saw that a couple of other groups published on serum biomarkers. So we thought, oh, that's very interesting, because we first thought that serum because it's very systemic, would mm-hmm. be having diluted biomarkers, so it wouldn't be as good. That's why we started with mucus in the first place. We had the idea that maybe the combination of both would be even better. So we designed that study to compare mucus and serum biomarkers prospectively over 9 time points to see which medium and which medium biomarker combination would be actually best for 6 different parameters we chose for that study.
And where did those 6 parameters come from?
So the 6 parameters were first detectability in ELISA. So if the biomarker can actually be repetitively measured via an ELISA to be able to be reliable. The second was variance. So is there a large variance within the biomarker measured between different patients? The third was the effect of surgery. So after surgery, what happens with a biomarker in mucus and serum? Does it drop? Does it go up? Is there actually such a significant change after surgery that we can say from a pathophysiological standpoint, the biomarker actually measures what it should measure, mm-hmm. like changes in disease, in this case, surgery? The fourth was correlation to the NPS.
And which is the nasal polyp score.
Yes, the nasal polyp score. And we chose the NPS as a mean for disease severity. We had long discussions which parameter to choose here, but we chose the NPS just to make sure that we have something a little bit more objective than just symptoms. Mm-hmm. So that was why we chose the NPS to correlate the biomarkers to, and actually also the follow-up of the biomarkers. Then we had as a fifth parameter, we had recurrence prediction. So can our serum or mucus biomarkers predict recurrences over a follow-up of 2 years? And the sixth was, are our biomarkers stable during the sampling times? So between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. So these were the six parameters we analyzed in our study.
Wow, that was a very thorough evaluation of these characterization of these biomarkers. So you kind of jumped right into the study, but let me back you up just a little bit. Can you summarize in general the study design, just to give our listeners an idea of exactly how you did the study, who you took these samples from, and where you got these samples from?
Mm-hmm, sure. So we included 61 patients, all with nasal polyps. And we had them on steroids before, but when they were non-respondent to steroids, they had a four-week washout period for systemic steroids, for topical steroids, and also for antibiotics. And then they underwent FES.
So, which is the sinus surgery?
Yes. So a functional endoscopic sinus surgery after a standardized protocol, how we do it here, but it's basically international. And all of these patients were followed over 9 time points. So the first time point was right before the surgery. And then there were 9 time points after surgery, which were basically 3 weeks after the surgery, then 1.5 months, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, 18 months, and 24 months. So total follow-up of 2 years where the patient was followed, and at each time point, mucus was sampled, serum was sampled, and demographic parameters were sampled as well.
That's amazing. Did you end up getting a big dropout rate? Because that's a pretty long follow-up for these patients. Did you have a pretty good, you know, retention of the patients included?
Yeah, you're talking about exactly the point we had a couple of problems with. So we started with 106 patients, but we ended up analyzing only the 61 because that was the patient set where we had all the parameters we wanted to analyze.
Yeah, but that's still a great number. So awesome. So what would you say would be the most important take-home message? I know you looked at a number of different things, but what would you say was the most important take-home message for our audience?
So I think the most important take-home message is that, first of all, serum and mucus may be used for liquid biopsies, and then that it's important to ask the right question in order to find the right biomarker. So there might be different biomarker and medium combinations for a different question, either if you look at recurrence or if you look at the disease severity following, or if you look, for example, at the effect of surgery or recurrence monitoring. So that might all be different. But I think what was most interesting for me actually was that there seem to be different combinations that are best in mucus, and there seem to be different biomarker combinations that are best in serum. And I think that's interesting because, for example, for periostin, so we mm-hmm. chose 6 pilot biomarkers to just have an idea what to do with the study and like what the media would do. For example, periostin was a very good biomarker in serum and in mucus, which I think is a very interesting finding. Same for IgE. And we also find that cisstatin, CST1, is a very good biomarker in mucus. So I think when you try to sum up the results of the study, it's important to say that you have a specific combination in serum and a specific combination in mucus that will help you, hopefully in the future, to predict severity, recurrences. And basically what we all want is to counsel our patients to monitor the therapy, to adjust our therapy. And I think that's where we're in the far future probably going.
Well, so you mentioned periostin, and in your study, you said that it tracked probably the best with nasal polyp score. Can you tell us a little bit more about periostin, and is it biologically consistent that it would track well with the nasal polyp score?
Yeah, so periostin is a secreted extracellular matrix protein that is important for reconstruction, for tissue remodeling, for epithelial mesenchymal transition. And so it can basically be related to tissue healing, development, and disease. Mm. And it's also a marker for tissue damage. So I think it makes actually sense that we also know that from asthma, for example, where periostin is also a very good marker, especially for the allergic IgE-related asthma. So I think it makes actually sense that this marker is one of the best that came out in this study. And also when you look in the paper at the graphs and you look at the nasal polyp score and at the end at periostin, you don't have to look at the numbers, just how the graphs look, they look very mm-hmm. similar. Serum is a little bit with not that many amplitudes than mucus, but when you look just where it goes up and where it goes down, it's pretty similar. So to my mind, it actually makes a lot of sense that periostin came out as the best marker here. And we had also one previous study where periostin in combination with CST1 and PEP-A, so PEPylysin-1, was a very good predictor for early recurrences.
Wow, that's fascinating. So you mentioned about periostin, and you alluded to the fact that periostin has been shown to be a good biomarker for asthma. Are there currently other biomarkers that are clinically being utilized for asthma that you also looked at for chronic rhinosinusitis? And is periostin actively being utilized as a clinical biomarker for asthma?
We actually used IgE too because of this, because it's basically a general measure of allergic inflammation. Mm-hmm. And it's also been used in any other allergic disease, including asthma. And this is also true for periostin. The pulmonologists always tell us that both markers are the basis for their therapeutic monitoring and also for therapeutic changes. So if they want to escalate to a higher step, they look at these two parameters. That's also why we included them.
I see. But I don't know if you had a chance to look at this in your study, but is the combination of the two maybe even better correlating to nasal polyp score? Does it give you additional information, or do each of those biomarkers on their own relatively high correlation with nasal polyp score or disease severity?
That's a great question. So in this study, we only looked at them individually, but the next step is certainly to have more biostatistical analysis of this data to actually see if a combination of them has actually a higher sensitivity and specificity to be able to do whatever we want to have recurrence monitoring or disease severity monitoring. So this is definitely going to be the next step, but in this study, we just looked at it at the different biomarkers individually.
Got it. Another intriguing conclusion that you made is about mucus serpin F2. One of the parameters that you looked at, which I found fascinating, obviously very clinically relevant, is to be able to predict, you know, early someone who may have an early nasal polyp recurrence. And I believe that you identified mucus serpent F2 as a good biomarker for that. I guess, similar to the periostin question, does that make sense? What is serpent F2, and does it make biological sense that it might be a predictor for early nasal polyp recurrence?
So serpent F2 is an inhibitor of plasmin. So we're in the broad range of the fibrinolysis pathway. Mm-hmm. And we know also from other studies that in polyps, there is a lot of fibrin because it can get degraded. There also, serpin E1 is also an inhibitor of fibrinolysis. So we know that it's a lot of fibrin, and we know that there is a link to the complement system. We know, so that's the whole range. So for me, it actually makes sense that serpin F2 is a predictor because it's associated with so many different other pathways that may play a role in recurrence prediction. Mm-hmm. But if you're asking the question why only serpin F2, then I can't give you the answer at the moment because we're just in the beginning to understand the pathophysiology of the coagulation system for nasal polyposis. So I think we have to dive more into the pathophysiology to understand why it's actually increasing even before periostin or IgE or the other markers.
Yeah, I think that whole body of literature is actually quite fascinating, this correlation of nasal polyps and the coagulation pathway. We've seen similar things that it seems like fibrinogen and that those pathways are somehow involved in nasal polyp pathophysiology, but we don't have the exact mechanism. So it is fascinating that you identified a serpent F2, which is sort of broadly involved in that fibrin, you know, and fibrinogen sort of cascade. So that's fascinating. So I guess there's more to come there. One thing when I was reading your article, going into the discussion, and one of the parameters that you mentioned is this whole variance and a signal to noise. And you mentioned exosomes in your discussion as maybe a mechanism of improving the signal to noise ratio. And I believe you've done quite a bit of work on exosomes. Tell me a little bit, what are exosomes? You sort of alluded to it a little bit at the beginning of our conversation. What are exosomes? And, you know, do you feel like that might be a future for measuring biomarkers in CRS?
Yeah, thank you for that question. We came from exosomes because, as I said in the beginning, we came from the idea that tissue is kind of the gold standard. And with our non-invasive biosignature, we wanted to mimic tissue in the first place. So that was our original idea. So that's why we actually compared whole mucus and exosomes from mucus. And we could see that exosomes are closer to the tissue. And when you look what exosomes are little vesicles on the nanometer scale. They are secreted basically by all cells, and mm-hmm. they can contain DNA, RNA, proteins of the cell of origin. So they basically mirror the cell of origin. So it was no surprise to us that exosomes could actually mirror the tissue way better than the whole mucus, because we know that the nasal mucosa is the first defense against all toxins and pathogens. So in whole mucus, there is a whole lot of other stuff in there basically that could influence what's in there. So the exosomes are just the proteins or just the RNA, whatever we're talking about. So of course the signal to noise ratio is way better in exosomes for the reason I just mentioned. The only problem is that exosomes are very difficult to basically extract out of the whole mucus. There are several ways. Some include ultracentrifugation. You could use certain kits, but still it's time consuming and it's also very expensive. So it's nothing you could do in your daily practice as an otolaryngologist anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. So that's why we changed our thinking a little bit and said, okay, when we want to go like really as a point of care diagnostic, close to the patient, close to the bedside, we didn't use exosomes in this study because of that reason, just to see if it was more useful and could be performed by a broader physicianship, basically.
Got it. That makes a lot of sense. And then going to the whole concept of signal to noise, one thing we didn't talk about in detail is how you collected the secretions and the mucus. Does it make a difference, or did you guys look at whether or not sampling the mucus in certain locations in the sinus cavity made a difference?
That is another very good and important question. So in the first study back in Boston, we actually looked at different sampling points from, we use Mearseal sponges, so where the Mearseal sponges are located, and then compared the proteome. And we could actually see that the proteome varies so much even within that one person, depending on where you sample the mucus from. So, and I know that there are a couple of other sampling techniques out there, brushes or lavages, or there are so many other techniques. So it's really difficult to compare the proteome from our results to a proteome that has been sampled with brushes or lavages. And we even could show that within one person, there were greater changes than compared to a different person. So that you have to keep in mind just when you look at these proteomic data from anywhere. So it's always important to know where the sponges are sampled from. So we have a very standardized way to put them in, and it's always the same person or the same people, because we know exactly where to put them. So we always put them in the internal nasal valve to have the same or roughly the same spot. I mean, it varies depending on anatomy, but and that we can make sure that at least from this point, the proteome is stable.
Interesting. So I would have thought that you would have put it in the middle meatus, or I guess close to the attachment side of the middle turbinate, but you found that the most stable area was much more anterior than the sinus cavity. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, we actually started with the middle meatus, but this was mainly when we had the patients in anesthesia. Mm-hmm. And for patients that are in the office, we saw that we put them a little bit more anterior. So we saw that actually there was such a huge difference that in this study, we put them more anterior to actually be sure that there was no discomfort for the patient and that everyone could put them in and out for future studies.
Oh, that makes sense. Well, great. One of the things looking at the patients that were included or that ultimately stayed in your study, 100% looked like they were Caucasians and a majority were males. Do you have any data to suggest that these biomarkers would be or not be applicable to non-Caucasian, non-male patients?
I think to date we can't apply it to a broader population. And I also think that it's really difficult to compare our results from Europe to other continents even, although there also might be roughly the same structure or phenotype of polyps. I mean, we know from Asia that there are differences in the endotype, but also when I attend international meetings, I always think, oh, that's interesting, because I've never seen that. So I think it's really difficult to apply it to a broader population in general. I mean, if you say Caucasians in Boston or the east of the US, maybe. But if you apply it to, for example, the south, where you have a lot of fungal disease, where the climate is different, I always think that maybe the proteome is so different that it's really difficult to apply my results or our results to a different country, to a different region.
Wow. So this kind of leads me to then my last question. So what are the next steps for identifying clinically relevant and usable biomarkers for chronic rhinosinusitis? You brought up, I guess, a very important kind of barrier to the utilization of biomarkers, which is, you know, the variability that can exist just from environments and ethnicity. Do you think that down the road we will be able to have some sort of usable biomarkers? And what are some of the barriers that we need to, as a, I guess, as a society or as a healthcare, fix or solve before we are able to have biomarkers that are usable?
Oh, well, I think we're doing many, many steps right now, but I hope that at some point we're getting there. So I think the major obstacle is what you just pointed out, that we have so much variability in region, in endotypes, in other environmental, either allergies or other toxins that the mucosa has to cope with, that it's really difficult to just find one biomarker that works for all patients over the world. But to my mind, I think it's really important that everyone works together for exactly this reason, so that we have a very large database and maybe new techniques like machine learning or something like this can help us to analyze a little bit of that. We have so many biomarkers. We have so many different variables to help us see which the direction is where we need to go, because I think it's really, really complicated. The pathophysiology is really complicated, and that's why the biomarkers are very complicated. So I think that's a key point, to have access to a broad database and then have a very good and broad evaluation of the results. So I think this is key. And I also think that it's always important to ask the right question in order to find the right biomarker. So, for example, when you want to have a good biomarker for biologics, it might be a different one for each biologic, and it might be a different one if you want to see if you're fasting fine or if there is a recurrence. So I think as a field, we have to be very specific in asking questions in order to get very specific biomarkers as a result, and then try to develop them and validate them together in order to be able to use the biomarkers not only for that one male Caucasian population, but for everyone, and that every patient basically can benefit from the biomarkers, and we can actually adjust the therapy based on these biomarkers.
Oh, that's excellent. And, I think that the relationship or the similar collaboration that you've established between coming over here and spending some time with the Mass Eye and Ear Group and Dr. Blyer, and then going back to Germany to where you practice is a great example of, you know, how we can further improve our, you know, these international collaborations, to your point, address at least one of these issues, which is identifying biomarkers that could be utilized for multiple different populations and cohorts. Well, Serena, Dr. Mueller, you've done an amazing work. This was not the only one that I've read from you. So congratulations on your whole body of work, and looking forward to hearing more about some of the studies that you have. And hopefully we'll be able to chance to meet in person. I'll be in Dublin. I don't know if you will be as well, but hope to have a chance to say hi to you in person.
Same here. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thank you, and have a good rest of your day.
Thank you, you too.
So if you want to hear more about Dr. Mueller's work, as I mentioned, the manuscript is entitled Comparison of Mucus and Serum Biomarker Sampling in Chronic Rhinosinusitis with Nasal Polyps, and it can be found in this month's edition of IFAR. Thank you and good evening.